ask yourself is, what frequency and what power? If I'm building a transformer that's going to work at 60 cycles, and if I want 100 watts of power to go through that transformer, regardless of what output voltage I want, regardless of what input voltage I'm starting off with, I might be starting off with 120 volts of Con Ed power, and maybe I want 850 volts of output. That's telling me a certain turns ratio. You would think that the voltage I want at the output and the voltage I'm starting at the input would have something to do with what I'm about to say. It almost does not. All I care about is what frequency, 60 cycles, what power, 100 watts. With those two pieces of information, if I'm a smart guy, it allows me to select a particular piece of iron that I'm going to make into laminations for the transformer, and those laminations have to have a particular size, a particular cross-sectional area, and the hole where I'm putting in the holes where I'm putting in the wires have to have a certain area to them. So the size of the iron of the transformer is primarily defined by watts and frequency. Turns ratio and voltage is almost not a factor if I'm designing a particular transformer. And once I design that transformer, in the ideal world, I have enough turns in the primary that the inductance of the primary is a big enough number. Let me drop. It's a big enough number of inductance of primary, enough Henrys, so that the inductive reactance is a big enough number so that if I take the unloaded transformer and simply connect the primary winding to Con Ed, 120 volts, I'd like the current flowing through the transformer to be a very small number. The unloaded current, I'd like it to be a very small number. I'd like the input inductive reactance of the primary winding to be a great big number. I'd like it to be, let me pick a number, 1200 ohms. Therefore, the transformer would only draw a tenth of an ampere when I put 120 volts across it. I'd like 1200 ohms or even more of inductive reactance. That determines a certain number of turns of the primary with a certain cross-sectional area of a certain kind of iron. That's the beginning of the design. When you're building a balancing device like figure number one, using a whole bunch of other characteristics. So transformer action is sort of there, but very indirectly. In the case of a balancing device like the one that I use at 915 megs, let me drop, the so-called core, to go up way high in UHF frequency, 915 megacycles, with a transformer, you either need ferrite-like device with extremely fine grains so you don't get a whole lot of eddy current within the core of the transformer itself. I'm trying to design a core that has very low RF loss at 915 megacycles. And to make there are very few ferrites that work well up at that higher frequency. That means that quite possibly this particular balun that I'm talking about, this mini-circuit balun with this red hard material, might not be a ferrite at all. It might really be just a ceramic core that acts like an insulator that holds everything together. It might really be an air core transformer. So when you're properly designing a balun, there's a bunch of other characteristics beyond transformer action. Yes, there's some transformer action there, but it's sort of secondary to a whole bunch of other conclusions, other criteria you got to go through. I didn't say this is easy. I didn't say that you guys are going to walk away from this particular Mel and Dick classroom and Mel, Dick, and Bill classroom and be ideal balun designers. I'm just telling you what the benefits are when you choose the right one and use it properly. I'm telling you what the benefits are, how I made measurements of those benefits, and trying to give you a little bit more understanding of what's going on. With all the words that I've said here, Mel might have some comments on this because Mel's the guy who's getting all these emails on balun. I'm hoping what we've said so far is somewhat helpful. And if not, tell us where we should go from here, Mel. You're the guy who's getting all the flack. K2KEY, K2LIW in the TechNet.
This is K2KEY. Well, okay, I'm going to go about this a little bit different, but I got a number of people with email questions here. But let me digress a little bit, as we explained, Dick, last week. about Balanced Simplified, that the reason we were putting that in the line, as we explained last week, is to reduce the inverted L type of mode that shows up with a dipole where the transmission line becomes part of the antenna system. In some cases, undesirable, except for the ones that we mentioned where they have installed vellum at different points in a transmission line and called control feeder radiation. That's basically what it was, and it was pioneered quite a bit by a gentleman by the name of Sievick, L.B. Sievick, W4RNL. Now, let me talk to you about Grinnella and Ruth Ross and their relationship to Jerry Sievick, who is more of the modern designer of what we see in a number of pieces of literature. Let me let it drop. Jerry Sievick, as he explained, and in fact a very good letter that he wrote answering some questions about some of his work, he wrote a letter to that time to Bob Wilson, who was consulting technical editor of Communication Quarterly. And one of the questions, he explains that his work on balance actually began while he was working at Bell Labs, and his teacher or his mentor at the time was a fellow by the name of Clyde Ruth Ross that we mentioned. Now, Clyde Ruth Ross, as he explained, he got most of the early information from George Grinnella, who did the work in the 40s. You got to remember, coax was fairly new at the time. You go back to the 30s, little or no coax was used, especially by ham radio operators, that the coax really didn't come into its own until around World War II. So that the Grinnella balance that he designed, basically working with open wire lines, so that's where most of the Grinnella balance, the early versions that later became Ruth Ross, were basically designed for unbalanced to unbalanced, known as the unit. Let me let it drop. A question that Dick brought up about why they didn't have dots placed on certain parts of the transformers. I was asked that, and I didn't research that out. And as Jerry Sievick basically said, he says, okay, I'll quote it because it's quite a long letter, but he says basically, I see that practically everyone still perceives these devices as conventional transformers that transmit the energy from the input to an output by flux linkages. They don't all look like the old classic Ruth Ross and Grinnella did, as chokes that isolate the input from the output and the transmission lines that transmit the energy by efficient line mode. In fact, accurate insertion loss measurements on these devices showing much lower permeability, ferrite, and polymer iron losses than were ever achieved in the early work. Now, let me let it drop again, and I'll bring up this thing about, about putting dots in. Number of people asked that, he says, and as Jerry explained, my formal training didn't include technique as part of the curriculum when I was studying engineering, science, and applied physics. I learned about these broadband transformers, like I said, from my colleague, Clyde Ruth Ross, and therefore his paper, Ruth Ross' paper of 1959, which became the industry standard, did never use the dots, so I never continued with it either. So there's the reason that you do not see any dots on any of the information that came after Jerry Sievick took over.
Okay, turns out that the data sheets supplied by Mini Circuits on all of their balancing devices do include dots. And I think it's a good thing to do, and let me give you an example. If I go to figure number one of that website that Bill, WB2QGZ, suggested that we go to, And it's the website that has a compacted URL that was given to us by Paul, WS2S. When you go to that website and you look at figure number one, unfortunately, it's missing dots. If that figure was part of the data sheet from many circuits, the dots would be present. There would be a dot alongside of the primary winding at lead number one, not lead number two, lead number one of the primary winding. I'm going to call it primary. There would be a dot near number one. On the secondary winding, three and four, there would be a dot near number three. To a smart engineer, what those dots are indicating is polarity. If, for instance, I applied a voltage to pin number two, bear in mind that pin number one is grounded, and I apply a voltage only to pin number two, I am putting a voltage across the primary winding. Because of where the dots are located in what I just told you, indicating that the polarity commonality between primary and secondary, if I had put one volt with reference to ground on pin number two, and pin number one is grounded, between pin number three and pin number four, you would also get exactly 1 volt in phase. So therefore, as far as this whole circuit is concerned, I decided to do an experiment. I maybe do have a load on the output from four to two, and maybe I don't, doesn't matter. I apply a voltage to pin number two. The exact same voltage will appear on pin number four. It will follow, even though the signal generator on the left, the V sub G, is putting out nothing. That's what that polarity is telling me. The fact that the balancing device follows in that manner gives me a little bit of hint about the way it does current isolation. This is also called a current balance. I can do anything I want to the common mode impedance on the right-hand side, and it acts like it's an open circuit to those leads that are partially grounded on the left-hand side. That's one of the benefits of this thing. It's giving you a kind of common mode isolation, and by putting those dots in the right place, it is telling a smart engineer that it's doing that. Let me drop. And if you want to make sure that somebody didn't miswire this thing, crossed up some of the leads, if you did put the dot not on 1 and 3, but put the dot on 1 and 4, I would get the exact same voltage. I apply 1 volt on pin number 2 with reference to ground. I will develop the same 1 volt across 3 and 4, but it will be out of phase. So therefore, when I did it with the dots in the right place, I apply a voltage on pin number 2 to ground, and pin number 4 develops the exact same voltage. If I was measuring any voltage from 2 to 4, even though I'm applying 1 volt, 2 to 4 would be 0, and the voltage generator would see nothing if I got the dots in the right place. If I got the dots in the wrong place, I apply 1 volt to pin number 2 with reference to ground. 3 and 4 develop 1 volt, but out of phase. Pin number 4 will develop 1 volt with reference to ground, out of phase. The voltage from 4 to 2, instead of being 0, will be 2 volts. I apply 1 volt, and I get 2 volts of differential difference. That's undesirable. So the dots tell me something valuable. So maybe there is a tradition of not putting in dots. To a smart engineer, you're denying him some of the information he wants to know. That's a strongly felt opinion. Regardless of what Mr. Ruffruff and Mr. Siebeck and Mr. Grinella and Mr. Civic said, I would like to see those dots. It tells me something I want to know. But maybe that's just me, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW.
EC2QIQ with a comment about convention.
Okay, yeah, Mel first, and then we'll go over to Glenn. Go ahead, Mel.
K2KEY, all right, to answer that. Grinella's answer to that question of dots also. He says, in my 1944 paper, I did not use dots. In fact, my coil transmission line at that time didn't even use cords. The answer again comes back from Bob Wilson, WA1TKH, I guess say, who was a consulting technical editor for the magazines at the time, says that, yes, he says, I agree. It's in a fact that all those that wrote in about the number of different articles written by Civic by Ruthrock, by Granella, that no dots were ever showed is because, as this by Bob Wilson quotes, it is not the industry standard for dots to be used. There's not an industry standard for the dots to be used. This is arbitrary. That's the answer that I got to the dots. Okay, I'll leave it at this point, and then I was going to go on with other subject that's involved with this, with unions and all, but maybe I better hold off because it's getting late. Let me hear what Glenn has to say, Dick. Over.
Yeah, once again, what Wilson and everyone else seem to be saying is that the tradition is we don't put in the dots. Well, from my point of view, you're denying the customer useful information. If the guy has some transformer savvy, he wants to know the polarity of the windings. These schematic diagrams without the dots, even though I may have in my hand a so-called balancing device that exactly follows that schematic, that doesn't guarantee it's going to do what I want, and I can't be sure without those dots. To me, they're important. But maybe that's just me. See what Glenn's got to say on all this. KC2QIQ, I bet you'd use some balance in your time, Glenn. K2LIW in the deck net.
Yeah, good evening, Dick. Good evening, everybody on the net. Just a couple of quick words about conventions of transformer winding and where the dots originally came from. What they did was, mechanically, when you're winding a transformer, you usually start the transformer winding in a direction. In other words, normally there's a winding machine. So you place a wire on a pin, and where you start, that's usually called the dot. So to the person who's manufacturing, they put a dot, and then they start winding it. So, or if you have a toroid, all the wires that start on, let's say, the left side of the hole are the starts. The ones that come out on the right side of the hole are the finishes. So usually the dots meant starts, and they do represent polarity. But what happened was, as conventions changed, they were replaced by numbers. So typically, all of the odd numbers, like your 1, 3, 5, 7, you know, etc., would be the starts. And the finishes would be your 2, 4, 6, the even numbers. So typically, when you look at conventions, if you don't want to use the dots, you basically just use numerics. And you know that the polarity is basically odd and even numbers. So your even numbers, and you can mark it either way, as long as you just make sure that, you know, all the even numbers are on one side and the odd numbers are on the other side. But that's just a convention as time went by. And, of course, if you're not using a core, the numbers actually make more sense because you're not demonstrating a winding around a bobbin where you're starting and ending, you know, windings on a transformer. So in a balun, in many, many, many cases, the numbers actually represent the polarity much better as odd and even numbers, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Darn interesting. I'm glad you told me that one, Glenn. So therefore, on that figure number one of this website, the dot was virtually there. I wasn't smart enough to recognize that. So the odd numbers on the terminals of a winding indicates the start. The even numbers indicates the ending, and there's a problem though, Glenn. I can start on number one and wind toward number two. I can start the secondary winding at number three and wind toward number four. Start and stop, odd and even, I've done that right. However, if I start on number one and wind toward number two clockwise, I start at number three and end at number four, but I'm winding counterclockwise, I'll end up with the wrong answer. Even though the start, odds are start and stops are even, if I make the mistake of winding in the wrong direction, and you'd be amazed how easy that is to do when you take twisted pair that you're putting through a core to make a balun, and you goof up the red and the green wires at one end. Start and stop is right, polarity would be wrong. Well, I still think I want dots, Glenn. KC2QIQ, K2RIW.
Well, see, the dots and the numbers actually do represent, and the reasoning that that's not completely valid is because in a closed core, let's say if you have a closed path length, like a toroid, whether you wind to the left or you wind to the right, the coupling may not be as good, but you're going to still have the same polarity. So in other words, as long as you start by going into the hole from one end, the start is still a start, and the finish that comes out the other side is still a finish. So if you were to take a toroid and just start winding one winding through it and winding to the left, and then you went through and wound the other end to the right, you still have the same polarity. The only time that that becomes more of an issue is if you're doing like air wound coils. Then yes, you have a polarity associated to an air winding where you don't have a closed path length, if you follow what I'm saying. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
In the case of the toroid, I'm going to agree with you, Glenn. If I really start at the hole of the toroid that's closest to my face, and that's always the start on every winding, and the hole, the portion of the hole that's furthest from my face is the ending, then yes, I can't get it wrong. However, in that toroid that's supplied to me by mini circuits, it is a chunk of material with not one hole, but two holes. And although I'm starting on pin number one and winding toward pin number two, I'm going into the left-hand hole and coming out of the right-hand hole. And then on the secondary winding, three and four, I start at number three, but I happen to go into the right-hand side and come out of the left-hand side. I'm now turning the turns through the two holes in the opposite direction. I'll have the right schematic diagram. I'll have the right start and stop. I'll end up with the wrong polarities. So toroids, I can't get it wrong. A two-hole toroid, I think I can get it wrong. KC2QIQ, K2RIW.
No, I agree with you that, but there again, I don't believe that the dot or the number is going to help you there, because it just requires that somebody has an understanding of the geometric layout of the magnetic material that they're using. Because here again, if you have a most bobbin course, you can wind to the left or wind to the right. But in other words, when you're starting a winding to the left, you have to realize that that's the start and where the other finishes are. So it does require, whether it's numeric or a dot, that somebody has an understanding of the magnetic material that they're using and where the starts and the finishes take place.
Okay, odds are start, evens are ending. And I've got a two-hole or I've got a bobbin. I got something where I can wind it clockwise and counterclockwise. The dots confirm for me polarity, assuming the manufacturer is telling me the truth. If I have any doubt, with the dots, I can confirm that he did it right. I can express a voltage across pin 1 and 2 and call it primary. I can look at the phase of what comes out of 3 and 4 and confirm that it's in phase or out of phase. The whole damn assembly may be potted. I can't inspect it with my microscope. It's under a whole bunch of black epoxy. However, I've got these two leads called 1 and 2. I can put a voltage across it. I got the other two leads, 3 and 4. I can look at the polarity of what comes out. The dots tell me what polarity I'm supposed to get. I can confirm that I'm getting the right polarity, and I can say, yes, this one was assembled correctly underneath that epoxy that I can't see. I still want the dots, Glenn. Maybe I'm persnickety. KC2QIQ, K2RIW.
Well, here again, I think it's just convention, because if you, wherever one is, you put a dot. If you see three, put a dot. If you see five, put a dot. If you see seven, put a dot. You two, four, six, and eights, you don't put dots. So you could draw them in yourself, but the numbers will tell you where the dots are.
Now that's if the manufacturer did it right, and there are companies that produce things like this in such mass production that they're selling them for 89 cents a piece. The people doing the assembly, in many cases, do not speak English. They were told to do it this way. The guy went to lunch, came back, and forgot, and did it the other way. Your ohm meter says everything's hunky-dory. The dots on the page, the odds and the even tell you where the start and stop is. But that man, with only partial understanding of what he was told to do, can do it backwards, even though the starts and stops are correct. Because one of the windings is upside down, voltage-wise, winding direction-wise, compared to the other, the dots, in theory, tell me that there was a final testing procedure in which somebody measured the polarity of what occurs between the apparent primary and the apparent secondary. The dots give me one more step of assurance if the final testing department is really doing their job. See where I'm coming from on this one, Glenn. K2 KC2QIQ, K2LIW.
Oh, absolutely, Vic. It's always a horror show. As a matter of fact, I can just tell you with experience being an engineer who designed transformers for years, balans and combiners, dividers, and explaining polarity to people, you'd be amazed at how many engineers don't even understand it correctly. And I have to sit down and draw diagrams and then take the physical component and then hold it in my hand and put it in their hand and say, this is where, you know, the polarity is starting and stopping. But yeah, you're right. It takes, you know, a lot of experience. People have to really, you know, that's why when you have an experienced department that works with magnetic materials and transformers, you need experienced people. You need people who understand these things. And many times when you have two devices that look alike, and you have to explain to all the mechanical designers all the conventions, it's an always an ongoing issue. And it's something that, you're right, especially whenever you start or, you know, manufacturing lines start and stop for a while, it's amazing how these problems do pop up occasionally, and whether there's dots or whether they're numbers, they seem to mess it up either way, Dick. That's been my experience so far. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Okay. What you're saying is that I'm a little bit persnickety to insist on the dots, that it gives me a little bit more confidence, but I can still be lied to because the final testing department did not measure polarity across the transformer action. I agree with you. In other words, don't stake your life on it. Even with the dots, it can still be wrong. But the guys on Dover Street are pretty objective. After you've heard this discussion between Dick and Glenn, if you were starting off fresh, manufacturing a product like this, Mel, and you're coming out with a data sheet, you've read the traditional words from Seebeck and Wilson and Grinnell and whatever, and Civic. You've read the traditional words. You've heard the discussion of Glenn and Dick. So would your company decide to put dots on their data sheet to try to give the customer a little bit more of a warm and fuzzy feeling? Or would you leave the dots off in order to be more traditional? What would you do if you were starting to manufacture that product today, Mel? K2KEY, K2RIW.
I'll tell you exactly what Jerry Civic did, because he had a number of very involved pieces of vellum that went. Now, for instance, I'm looking at one now called the 12-to-1 vellum. And actually, what is it? In fact, basically, it's a combination of unum. It's a vellum connected to a unum. It's a Ruthroth vellum connected to a Cornella unum. And the reason for that is, when do you need such a thing? And then I'll tell you how he went about and why he said how he does it, and it may clear up a lot of this. Number one, he says in many cases where he's experimented with antennas such as rhombic and V antennas, he found he needed something that would represent some impedances around 600 ohms, which I did find, especially like on a big loop I have outside. And I solved the problem basically, as you know, of using open wire feeders, 600 wire feeders. And he went ahead and he showed how to make this contraption. And it is. It's a number of stacked toroids. And as I say, it starts out with a unit and winds up with a balance. So now, how do you go about winding this? And now he gives a lot of detail. So I'll tell you how he came up with the best answer. Let me let it drop. Glenn said that they use numbers like 1, 3, 5, 7, etc., 9 as the beginning, and 2, 4, 6, 8, etc. as the ending. Jerry does, he used his balance with basically a wire called thermalized wire. And the wire comes in different colors. So he has a brown wire, let's say it's winding number one. At the beginning of the wire, automatically the machine puts a black little stripe on the wire. In other words, it's a black stripe, let's say, on a brown wire. It runs through the system. It runs onto the toroid. He then says, let's say, the next one is a red wire, winding number two, red wire, just for argument's sake. It again puts a black dot on the beginning of that red wire indicating the beginning. So now you know that that's the beginning of the red wire. The other end hasn't got a black dot. That's the end. This way there is no confusion which winding is which, where the beginnings are for wiring. Dick, this is the way he explains how he comes up with his proper and very involved wiring of this 12-to-1 ballum that is basically a unum and a ballum over.
Yeah, there are at least two circumstances, Mel, where I 100% agree with you. And there's a third circumstance where I don't quite agree. Let me show you what I mean. If the guy is really following proper orders, the assembly person, and each of the stock windings have got a black stripe on each of the colors, and they're all being wound in the same direction of a bobbin, or, that's case number one, or if you're using a toroid, where you can't get the directions wrong, if you start them all on one side of the toroid and end them all on the other side, then I've got to agree with you. It's essentially foolproof. But for the guy who's winding a, and there's a third situation where it's correct. On many of these ballons, the multiple windings are first twisted together as a bifolar or a tripolar of two or three colors of enameled wire. The wires first get twisted together to make sure you've got tight coupling between the primaries and secondaries and tertiaries, so to speak. Then, because they're twisted together before the winding takes place, automatically the turns are always in the right direction. But there are a few kinds of balloning devices. Let me drop. There is a fourth situation where the wires are not first twisted together as bifolar, trifolar, and quadrifolar, and you have individual starts and stops on a bobbin-like structure, not a toroid. I could get one of those windings in the wrong direction. I'll end up with the wrong polarity. The impedance matches will be terrible. The isolation will be terrible. So even though starts and stops are correct for a bobbin-like device or a two-hole-like piece of ferrite or iron or whatever, or ceramic holder, for a two-hole or a bobbin, there's a slim possibility I can get it wrong. I like dots, indicating voltage polarity under magnetic working conditions. Pure starts and stops are foolproof on a toroid. They're not foolproof on a non-toroid. For a person who might misunderstand his assembly instructions. Yes, the dots don't guarantee that he did it right. In theory, when they do final testing of impedance or common mode impedance, they're going to discover the error. Well, that's the good news. Let me drop. When it comes to a device that is mass-produced at very low prices, the bad news is that they do not test them in the final testing department. They'll build a production run of 10,000 of them. At best, somebody will pick two or three out of that batch and make a measurement. And he prays that the other 9,997 were built the same way. You sometimes can still run into a problem. I'll admit there's no ideal solution here. What is the disadvantage, Mel, of putting in the dots? Yes, you're breaking a tradition. And because each of those guys say, we've never done it that way, what in your mind is the disadvantage of putting in a dot? You're not wasting a lot of money to put that ink on the page. K2KEY, K2LAW.
Twist to get quotes. Bob Wilson, WA1TKH, representative, consulting technical editor and technical engineer for Private PE. He's got a whole bunch of different trees and things that he mentions that he answers the question. This is not a standard of industry. That's the bottom line. Not a standard of industry. And so Jerry Civic sort of agreed, and so did Ruthroth and Grinnella. You'd have a little bit of sit down with them, I think, Dick. You'd all have a good, a good talk. I don't know if you'd convince them or they would convince you. This is the bottom line. And in fact, with Jerry Civic here, 12-to-1 down, like I say, very intricate piece. see, 1, 2, 3, 4. Four windings on the union section, and 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 windings on the balance section to come up with this 50 ohms to 600 ohm type of device, which is quite an intricate device. However, it is available at one time from Amazon Associates, and it is in color-coded wire with wire that has dots on the beginning. And the different, in other words, each color has a black dot on the to indicate the beginning of the winding. I would assume, I would assume with the automatic machines, I would doubt very much of anybody sitting there and hand wiring, winding any of these devices anymore, Dick. So I'm sure that with by automatic machines, you could not make it a reasonable price if you're going to stand there and hand wire this stuff. So all this stuff, other than what goes to hands and kit form, is going to be machine wound, and I don't think you're going to find any kind of problem with maybe the machine wound pieces of any kind of coil today, to tell you the truth, Dick, over.
Okay, I looked at a number of these mini circuits, two-hole balance, one-to-one balance, current balance, Type 1 granella, we'll call it what we like. I looked at a number of them under a microscope. Very fine red and green wire, twisted together as a bifiler, pushed through tiny little holes of this core, a two-hole core, multiple turns of that bifiler goes through the core, and then those wires get spot welded down to the pads. I looked at a number of them under a microscope, and I can see differences from serial number 1, 2, 3, and 4. It is my belief that these were hand-done, because the product itself, the core that they're wound on, the core that has the two holes in it, has an outer dimension of about 30 thousandths of an inch, maybe 40 thousandths of an inch, 1 millimeter, my recollection of the outer dimension of the core. To make an automatic machine to take bifilar windings with red and green and properly color code them and put them in the right place. The left-hand input terminal is always the red wire. So the machine has to have vision and know which is red and green, thread them through these tiny little holes by multiple turns, and then again have vision to recognize the red and green on the output. Can you make an automatic machine do that? Yeah. I don't think so. I think they were hand-done. Since I think there's a human being involved, there's the possibility of a human error. On top of that, Mel, when I go buy power transformers from a quality manufacturer, the majority of those quality manufacturers do put dots on the schematic diagram of the transformer spec sheets. So transformer manufacturers, the high quality ones, do give you dots indicating phase or polarity of all of those windings so that you can combine them in combinations and know what you're going to get. And since these balans do have a certain amount of transformer action to them, even though it's RF frequency transformer action, I see some advantage of the dots. So again, each of those guys with all of their credentials are telling you the tradition. My real question is, if you were manufacturing them, and a small percentage of your potential customers, like K2RIW, would be a little bit happier to see the dot on the schematic, what would it cost you to put the dot on the data sheet? What would the disadvantage be of putting on the dot? Yes, you're breaking a tradition, but you would increase the number of customers. Would that give you an incentive to do it? It costs you nothing, and it increases your sales. If you and I were running a company, we might have a slight difference of opinion on this one, Mel. I think it costs you nothing except the price of an ink dot, which is not measurable, and it increases the number of people who are going to buy it. Maybe it's not a huge increase, but every bit helps. K2KEY, K2RIW.
first of all, let me ask you something. Are you referring to like a winding on what they known as the binocular type of a core, Dick, over?
Yes, I am. It's a two-hole core. You and I would call it a binocular core. And yes, I'll admit that if the wires are twisted together first, as a bipolar, it's almost impossible to get it wrong. I'm going to admit that. But there are kinds of balance where the wires are not twisted together, and therefore, in that binocular core, one winding could go through clockwise, one winding can go through counterclockwise. To a casual observer of that binocular core, you might not catch it, and it would not work correctly. Over to you, Mel.
Okay, why I brought this up about the binocular core. Now, I'm going to ask you another question because you, I guess we're both in the same boat, born in about the same time, born in, you know, went through the world of electronics together. You remember on the television set of the 50s and all, when they used 300-ohm cable, do you remember what the matching network from the antenna, that little piece that was mounted on the back of the tuner, do you remember what that looked like, over?
Yeah, there was a sort of an air core-like balancing device that took the 300-ohm balanced input and converted it to something like, maybe it was 50-ohm or 100-ohm unbalanced output, which eventually ended up on the control grid of a 6J6 tube. I'm a little bit fuzzy now on what that thing looked like. You're going to have to describe it to me, Mel. Go ahead.
Dick, I think they call those gimmicks.
They were binocular. If you remember, they were little binocular cores, just like we're talking about now, made out of ferrite. And, no, these were not gimmicks. These were actual transformers, as you said, 300, because what used to happen, every so often you hear one got burned up because it was right across the 300-ohm wire. However, why I brought that up, I'm going to go back to, if you remember, when the IEEE used to have their shows there at the Coliseum. I stood there and I looked at the machine that was demonstrating making that exact part, automatically taking that binocular little device, that ferrite, little ferrite piece, and putting that winding on that was for the tuners, and they were their customer at the time. I asked the guy, I said, I bet I know, who's your biggest customer? He says, I bet you can't guess. I says, I bet RCA. He says, how did you know? I says, I recognize that core mounted on that little plate. And that machine would knock them out. I mean, you know, you couldn't, of course, count how fast that thing was knocking out those little matching networks, Dick, over.
Okay. Now, in those days, Mel, when you had a big variable air capacitor in a transmitter, when you had great big air variable capacitors in a receiver, most components in those days were large. And the people who cut their teeth in those days, like you and I, when you pick up a modern day piece of electronics on a 14-layer PC board, and you got 0201s and 0402 surface mount resistors that you can just barely see under a 30 magnification stereo zoom microscope with a fiber optic lighting system. Take the size of modern day components that are so extremely small and so densely packed on those PC boards, and the toroids that go with them are in some cases microscopic. And if I compare that to the size of that binocular core you and I remember from the 1950 time frame, I'll bet you that core was quite a bit larger than the ones that are used today. You saw a beautiful automatic machine on that size binocular core. I'm a little worried about, would that machine be able to make these super miniature ones that are done today? Probably they are automated. But if they're automated, they would have been like a cookie cutter. I see specific differences between serial numbers. So I'm worried that maybe an automatic machine was not used on the ones that I received. And I'm buying a part that's been in their catalog for probably 8 years. So it's not a brand new part. We've got 4 minutes left. KC2KEY, KQIW.
C2QIQ with a comment?
Mel first. Go ahead, Mel.
I have a run to my friend that worked for Minicircuits. He was an engineer there, and Minicircuits, in fact, was still, as I think they still have the office there. It's only about 4 or 5 blocks away, and then they moved to another place about a mile away from me, a little larger place. And, yeah, well, you look on a lot of these boards, they've got some very small type of pores and everything, and I sort of question, you know, they do have, you do see some very mini type of little toroid in a number of different circuits and things and multi-winding. I don't know if somebody's really sitting and I can actually hand-wire one of those things, Dick. I would almost suspect that it is done by automatic machinery today. Everything is done by automatic machinery today. You wouldn't want to try to assemble any of these boards and things today. Of course, everything has to be done by a fast production, because you're never going to get the price, you know, within a competitive price. So you know that if it's going to be a part that's going to be needed for, you know, a lot of components that are going to have to be used in a system that's going to be repeated over and over again, and a common component of it, they're going to mass produce it in some way, Dick, over.
You're probably right. And I may have misjudged. Glenn, you've only got 2 minutes left. Go right ahead.
Well, I've seen some of these very, very small magnetics that are, you know, that I personally use the in both Ethernet connectors, the RJ45s. We actually put little filters inside there for the PoE to decouple, you know, the DC from the gigabit signal. And they have machines that are basically called micro shuttles. They actually are very, very small little piece that actually you put all the wire on, and it goes on this micro shuttle, and you can do that basically one transformers in something about the size of like a 1206 resistor. It's very, very small, and it can be done either it's just a very, very low volume. You can actually use this machine manually and kind of like count the turns yourself and just do, you know, very, very low volume. But there again, you can use the same machine and you know, connect it up to a CAT system. And basically, it'll run automated in high volume. So it can be done either way, Dick. Usually, the prototypes and or low volume output, it can still be done. It's not exactly handmade, but it's like machine assisted, so to speak. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Don, interesting. Okay, you guys have spent another 4 hours of your life listening to this jazz. Hope you got something out of it. This was TechNet number 1,279 of the series that began in September of 1982, 27 years ago. There must be more questions to be answered. Try to be kind to each other. We'll be back next week as long as we all stay healthy. We'll gather the clan and try to go a little bit further forward. On a quick break, Glenn, were you at the shindig this afternoon, this morning? Were you there at the college, so to speak?
My intention was to be there, Dick. Unfortunately, I wasn't able to make it. I got pulled aside on something else early this morning, and unfortunately, I wasn't able to make it. But hopefully next time. I missed out on a lot, I heard. K2RSW, KC2QIQ.
Okay, now I feel better. I didn't just miss you. Not to worry. Mel? Tie on the ribbons, please. KQRIW.
If I knew you were going to go, Dick, I guess I would have dragged myself out of bed. Basically, I'm going to say one more thing. A friend of mine was in the importing business. He went to Japan, bought a lot of VCRs with his name on it, because he did buy a tremendous amount, hundreds of thousands of pieces for importing to another country. And he told me, he says, the quote was that when you take the VCR out of the box, the consumer, you're the first human person to touch that VCR. The entire machine was down to now making them strictly by machine, to the point where it's even boxed by machine. He went there and he said he observed all these robots working in total darkness, 24 hours a day, making VCRs. And that's it. So can you imagine the complete machine is assembled without a human hand, Dick? Over.
Wow. Okay. Bye-bye for now. Back to you for any other final mail. See you guys next week.
So with automation today, I doubt if a little coil is going to be sit there and, you know, hand wiring that and all. But, okay, I could say if it's a mass production item, they're going to have a machine to do it. That's the bottom line. 73 is all. Thank you very much for joining us. Thank you for the emails. I didn't get to them all, but we'll do it again next week. Take care.
Thanks, guys. From 32Q, Chief said maybe you're real cross next week.
You got it, Bill.
Connecting.
Node number 9126.
Welcome to the New England Reflector 912.
Channel 6.
The time is 12:10 a.m. Program stations from all over the world actually control it and work the different free it is the first
How were you doing the remote controlling with the 8900? How did you get the computer link to it?
Okay, well, it's kind of weird and it's new technology. It's a little scratchy, your signal, but if it's possible, is there a way to call you on maybe your cell phone or whatever? I will explain to you because it's in work. I've made some of the world's most amazing airplane stations, and they're going 800 miles an hour through 20 meters, and I do have my very own server, just like AMS, like Ireland. I'm running the same software all from here, and then my 89 are linked into my computer, and by a certain program that we run, you can actually control it and transmit via it. Because it is legal, it is coming through me. And I have a friend, John, KGC, California, who would love to say hello to you if you have time. But do you have a cell phone, maybe? And I can explain real quick.
I don't have mine with me tonight. I'm asking you to do it for maintenance in the building here in Queens. What I will do is drop you an email, and I'd love to speak to you one day.
Right, no problem, no problem. Yes, thank you very much. And I do thank the LimeWalk repeater. I'm going to try to get in touch with someone there and see if I'm from time to time stay coming in and trying to make some contacts through there. You know, on the off hours where there's no traffic and nothing. The system I runs 3 hours a day, 7, and I have over 315 members within 1 year, and that'll show you how widespread this is. Right now on my Echolink server, I actually have 9 different repeaters and links connected parts of the world, and I also have an HF remote base that is live on 40 meters that you could actually hear if you were on Echolink, and actually transmit through by permission of the owner. So I also run video. That's another thing. I run video, which can hold 16 simultaneously, like a television, alongside our server, and you're welcome to check that out.
Very interesting. I'm going to take this also right here when I get back home. Well, not tonight. When I get home tonight, I'm going to hit the pillow. But tomorrow, I'll drop you an email in the morning. I'll see where I get. And, yeah, I'd be love to speak to you some more about this.
All right. No problem. No problem. If you don't mind, I'm going to let you say hello real quick before you leave to KG6NXX. He's going to be coming in from California and operating my radio on 146850. Just to say a quick hello to you, if that's okay. Give me your name and your call sign a little slower. I had to put the volume up on my radio. But if you don't mind, I'll give you a test and show you how crystal clear it is. I am running some serious filtering. I am running 30 megs of internet up and down, and everything that I run on the system is all through me here in Bronx, New York. If you're interested, over.
Sure, no problem. My name again is Bernie, B-E-R-N-I-E. My call sign is K2YO, Kilo 2, Charlie Oscar.
All right, no problem. Stand by one moment. Let me just hook the wiring up, and I'm going to bring KG6NXX, K2CYO. I have that here written down, Bernie. Your signal is a lot better now. On this 5 watts, am I crystal clear? And then I'm going to hook everything up so you can actually say hello to John.
Yes, you're definitely clear. You obviously have more than just a local antenna. I just have a quarter watt antenna or a quarter wave antenna stuck on a file cabinet. So, yeah, you're very clear.
Okay, stand by. Bernie, John's coming on in 2 seconds. He's going to call you. Stand by.
KG6NXX, is that you? Your audio is extremely low.
John,